Thank you, George. Dr. Ronald Berman was born in New York City and attended Erasmus High School, which I'm told was founded by the Dutch when New York was still New Amsterdam. He was city champion in the half mile and won an athletic scholarship to Harvard. After taking a BA in social relations, he worked on the Alcan Highway and then served in the Office of Naval Intelligence. On leaving the Navy, he went to Yale, receiving a degree in English literature. He worked first at Columbia, then at Kenyon College, where he became associate editor of the Kenyon Review. He was professor of Renaissance literature at the University of California, San Diego, before being appointed chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities by President Nixon. He served in that post through President Ford's administration, and that service was recognized by awards from Phi Beta Kappa, the American Council of Learned Societies, and his native city, which gave him the Medal of the City of New York. For the past year, Mr. Berman has been a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Berman has published works throughout this country and Europe. He is both an Oxford and a Cambridge author. Best known as a Shakespearean scholar, he has strayed somewhat into the study of modern culture. His best known work is America in the 60s, but he has also written this year for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Commentary, and other publications. Speaking on equality and culture, here is Dr. Berman.
Thank you very much. We all know that the 60s were a decade of revolution, but we know also that this revolution lost in politics. Richard Nixon beat George McGovern decisively. The Democratic Party came partly to its senses, and all around us we see short hair and hard work. Why is it then that, in a sense deeper than politics, we're not convinced that things came out right? Why do we feel the persistence of revolutionism, the fragility of institutions, and our vulnerability to ideas like equality, which seem to say one thing and mean another? I think because the battle of the 60s wasn't entirely political. For a short time, there was a political thrust to the radicalism of the decade. It quickly collapsed into theater, demonstration, and other forms of symbolism. But although radicalism was politically ineffective, it became culturally dominant. What mattered was its translation into ideas and sensibility. For example, feelings about authority, redefined morals and styles, movements around consciousness or liberation. The new politics never made it as far as party platforms, but a new set of cultural assumptions is to be found everywhere. By now, certain feelings and ideas or sub-ideas have been legitimated. It is more or less axiomatic that there's little authority beyond the demands of the individual will. Not much Nietzschean grandeur here. It is just that the idea of universal standards is no longer compelling. As far as equality is concerned, this implies something fairly new. The idea of equality has become bound to that of self-approval, and now means individualism without difference or limits, and with no particular relationship to institutions that once defined equality in a special religious and philosophical context. In the realm of culture, since the 60s, equality has come to mean that all experiences, ideas, preferences, and desires are the same. It suggests that distinctions and standards of taste, style, and judgment are unnatural, or at least not to the point. Logically enough, equality also suggests that no set of ideas matters more than any other. It seems frivolous, but nevertheless, government policies are quite capable of happily operating on that assumption. And the sociology of taste and style provides them with justification. Some time ago, a book titled More Equality argued that, quote, a culturally equal society would treat all ways of expressing oneself and acting as equal in value, status, and moral worth, because they express the differing aesthetic standards of people in different socioeconomic and educational circumstances, unquote. It makes a very important assumption that difference is in fact sameness, and it suggests more noticeably that no particular set of beliefs matters more than any other, unaware that the statement is a kind of Cretan paradox which sees the authority of its own source, or rather which uses the authority of that source to suggest that no source has authority. It plays on the moralism of ethnic equality and class equality, which accounts for its smarminess. Aesthetic standards become a form of class consciousness, which has never done much for either. The key to the passage is a special kind of implication, that taste and style, which are no more than personal desires ennobled as categories, are the determinants of social life. Since any human desire falls under the law of diminishing returns, it follows pretty clearly that there is no way that the amount or value of such desires can be limited. That's a pretty tall order, even for a democracy, especially for a democracy built upon a certain kind of assent. To turn from taste to taxes, it seems likely that every form of equity will justify its own funding under the current administration. A book hailed with enormous satisfaction by constituent interests, it is by the same author I mentioned, but more representative, I believe, than that would imply, suggests that federal policy should be based on subcultural programming. Here is how that is stated. Quote, there might be specific programming for avant-garde, low-culture pre-adolescence, which is to say, parenthetically, all of them, or for conventional upper-middle black young males. Subcultural programming would enable audiences to find content best suited to their wants and needs, unquote. The prose goes on, not all that readably, but it does go on to assert that government should identify diversity with equality. The language is practically a form of social coding. Every time we come across the phrase wants and needs, we know what to expect. To desire something is to have a legitimate claim upon taxation. And of course, this is not so much philosophical as political. Federal policy right now has asserted pretty much the same idea about equal rights in cultural affairs. The White House and the Endowments for Arts and Humanities intend to distribute funds, not exactly on the old basis of populism, which is the right to equal shares. The option, or rather the new notion, is that culture is the realm of ideas and desires themselves equal in value. The old debate between mass culture and high culture is only to a limited extent embodied in the opposition between elitism and populism. For a long time, until the passage of the 60s, really, American intellectuals saw mass culture as the byproduct of industry, advertising, and national bad taste. And under mass culture, they listed television and its effects, drugstore reading lists, the amusements of the common man. Almost universally, intellectuals were critical of the music, art, reading, ideas, taste, style, interests of our lowest common denominators. But in turning upon the politics of our system and the ideas underlying that politics, many who teach, write, or are otherwise reflexively within the world of ideas have reversed themselves. They are equalitarian about ideas, no longer critics or judges of performance, but of intentions. There are a number of rubrics covering this fairly profound change. Robert Nisbet sees the matter in moral terms and states in The Twilight of Authority that's a form of the subjectivism to which democracy has been reduced. Daniel Bell, in The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, writes about the end of modernism as the end of the ability of the middle class to express itself or to encourage artists to respond to its values. There are more ways than one to look at the issue, especially when we consider that middle-class society itself is hospitable to, and fairly pleased with, the more marketable aspects of adversary culture. From the bumper sticker to the college curriculum, there is a kind of fascination with social failure. The operative fact is that intellectuals now have moral reasons to oppose the discriminatory act of making discriminations. An enormous amount of drama, criticism, fiction, and simple admonition inform us that distinctions imply hierarchies, hence unworthy political opinions. The 60s began with the attempt to radicalize politics, while the 70s seemed to end with a more successful effort to politicize culture. There are books, primers really, which have by now become familiar as guides to undifferentiated mass life. And The Joy of Cooking has become a model for Baedekers on lesbianism, homosexuality, and Oriental philosophies reduced to spiritual massage. More ambitious books resolve all human anxieties, relationships, and uncertainties. In general, in this literature of positivism, it is assumed that standards of behavior are meaningless. Whatever is acceptable. Organizations of a certain kind define citizenship as collective preference, hence the Gay Alliance and other lobbies that interpret equality as sameness. The proliferation of such groups, the Times has reported efforts of paedophiliacs to assert the equality of their own preference, will soon make the party system of the Third Republic look monolithic. In all of this, the acquiescence of intellectuals or of technocrats is fairly plain. They have a considerable interest and investment in the criticism of society, and the adversary culture is a made-to-order vehicle for them. They are drawn to the negation of forms because of the nature of criticism and because of the nature of its concomitant politics. Those who would once have invoked proletarian literature and Soviet realism now have different weapons for use against the norms of middle-class life. The decibel level of rock was a kind of weapon against taste and judgment. The current elevation of science fiction means a corresponding loss in the authority of what has been replaced. When it is argued that any kind of art is as good as any other, that the intention to produce it is as good as production, or that we are all artists, something more serious than Dada is being proclaimed. The world of taste, style, and habit, which underlies political choice and its formulation, insists not only that all things are equally valuable, but that they are also equally valueless. Between the claims made for mass culture in the past and the claims made now for populism, intervened the cultural translation of the 60s. In the realm of art, cans of paint or plastic were poured onto the floor to take the ultimate freedom of their form. Lines of canvas, like dry wash, have been strung from one county to another. Flashing lights, blank canvases, and empty rooms enter the realm of seriousness. Perhaps prophetically, there was a large machine exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art whose sole function, successfully accomplished, was to destroy itself. In drama, people stripped naked in the aisles, decapitated chickens on stage, crucified animals, and performed ingenuities of intercourse, making art into happening, i.e., an event suggesting authenticity beyond criticism. In literature, William Burroughs wrote a sheaf of pages, cut them up at random, pasted different parts together, and published them to a good deal of critical acclaim. In music, the Beatles were proclaimed equal to Confucius. The general effect was to devalue culture and to make it impossible for the bourgeoisie to locate themselves in terms of values. If all experience becomes equal, then no part of it has any special authority in the interpretation of experience. History grinds on methodically, and now government agencies have become involved in cultural equality. There has always been congressional acceptance of the principle of distributive justice. That used to mean localities getting a return on their taxes in the form of grants or subsidies in some proportion to their contribution. It meant that regions represented on certain committees got funds proportionate to their influence. But the pace has quickened, and under this administration, there will be distribution of cultural and other funds by age, sex, income, race, and other categories. The Arts Endowment will continue to base its policy on some interesting assumptions. Among them, the idea that the artist matters, but that the work of art is meaningless. Now, this, of course, is the only conceivable justification for rewarding by constituency rather than for ability. Organizations and bureaucracies like state councils for the arts or friends of the arts will get increased funding because of their usefulness as lobbyists and voters. The same pattern will hold roughly true for the Humanities Endowment. It is now easier than it was a decade ago to reward ideas in proportion to their equality. Populism now means something more than the opposite of elitism. It carries along with it the implication that nothing can be disqualified from support. Now that it has been broadly accepted that every cultural enterprise has its own legitimacy, then it may indeed be elitism to withhold funds on the grounds of difference in quality. And in fact, new constituencies are arising, encouraged by the ideas around them and by the receptivity of the administration, who expect nothing less than acceptance and reward for everything. It turns out that those who used to worry about populism were insufficiently alarmed. The begrudging annual payoff of government to folklore or crafts or square dancing is in a different league from the methodical funding of all ethnic community or interest groups, or the extensions of every conceivable labor, educational, and urban association. The administration seems comfortable with the confusion and inequality that I have outlined. Its various spokesmen have agreed that culture is the combination of interests inherently equal, that elitism is the unfair imposition of standards, and that funding should embody the right of any collectivity to do whatever it wants. This is a lot different from the old opposition of high and low culture, or even of populism and the elitist position with which I've become happily identified. The distribution of federal cultural funds proceeds from the admission that taste is relative. Beneath that is the less conscious assumption that distinctions of mind, morals, and feeling don't matter very much. As Dr. Johnson might have said, it is astonishing, but not surprising. Thank you.